Hi, I'm Tony Cox, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of December 14th, 2012. Like most everyone in America, we were focused on the holidays as we produced the show this week. But that changed on Friday when we heard the news of a seemingly inexplicable school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. Today, we're thinking about all of the families whose lives have been shattered. When we hear news like this, our impulse is to reach out to find some way to help, maybe to give. That reaction is almost hardwired into our culture. It's even enshrined in our tax system. As we find ways to give to help support those Connecticut families, we want to dedicate this show to them and to the spirit of giving that marks this time of year. By now, most of us have some idea of what we'll be giving this holiday and what we're hoping to get.
I want to get an 81-key piano.
Puppy.
Yeah, we do want a Shiba Inu for Christmas. So we asked for from Santa at Macy's. We're simple people.
Spider-Man, everything. He's obsessed with Spider-Man, right?
I think as a gift I would like a nice pair of shoes.
Amazon gift card, because I'm uncreative.
A wand.
What?
A wand.
A wand, okay.
What did I ask for? I want a ticket to Disneyland, because I'm flying to California in March, and I can't afford to go unless someone else pays for my ticket.
And me, what do I want? I don't want anything for Christmas. I'm happy with what I have already, so I just want good health.
Will my parents hear this broadcast?
What do I want? You asked for makeup and lingerie.
Yeah, well, makeup and lingerie. Don't tell my mom. Don't tell my dad more.
There's joy in receiving what we want, sure, but there's a lot of satisfaction in giving as well. 'Tis the season, after all. So today, we're dedicating the show to giving. And we'll start with a look at something companies traditionally give around this time of year, bonuses. I came across an online greeting card the other day that said, Christmas bonus time, ... when the boss becomes the funniest person on earth. So, are you laughing or crying over your holiday bonus, or lack of one? For that matter, how many people still get a holiday bonus? We asked our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, to look into that. Bob, if you will, the envelope, please.
It's from my company.
Your bonus.
My bonus.
Maybe you can identify with this scene from National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. Chevy Chase's Clark Griswold has been anxiously awaiting this moment.
Open it, Clarky. Open it.
Yeah, I hope it's a fortune, Clark.
That scene shows how far we've come from employers giving small gifts like turkeys or watches back in the late 1800s to the cash payouts we associate with holiday bonuses now. Princeton sociology professor Viviana Zelizer says in 1902, J.P. Morgan helped usher in the practice, giving employees an extra full year's salary.
One can trace a transformation from a gift from the employer to the employee and gradually emerging as an entitlement, something that the workers expected.
By the 1950s, Zelizer says, the National Labor Relations Board ruled that unions could negotiate the bonus as part of the compensation package. Claremont McKenna psychologist Ron Riggio says there's a risk in giving holiday bonuses. Let's go back to that movie character Clark Griswold.
Griswold comes to expect the bonus, and so he's already sort of pre-spent it. And then the boss becomes essentially the bad guy in the whole scenario.
It's a one-year membership in the Jelly of the Month Club.
Oh, God.
Clark, that's the gift that keeps on giving the whole year.
It could be worse. I once got a package of hot dogs. Yes, Frankfurters from one of my early employers. And these days, management consultant Bruce Tulgan says the slow economy has caused the boss to cut back or even drop the time-honored holiday bonus altogether.
They see it as an opportunity to shift gears. Hey, we're not going to do this anymore, or we're going to change how we do this.
In that case, Claremont McKenna's Ron Riggio advises employers not to just give workers the silent treatment.
If you can't afford to give bonuses or, you know, you're unwilling to do it, explain why. That way the employees have clarity. Honesty and transparency is always the best policy.
There is some hopeful news about the future of the holiday bonus, at least among small businesses surveyed for American Express. Researcher Alice Braden says 2 years ago, 25% gave bonuses. Last year, it was up to 29%. And this year, more than a third of small businesses say they're handing out bonuses. Braden says that's not just good news for those receiving one.
I pretty much see bonus giving tracking to a business's ability to give a bonus. When they can afford to do it, they do it. So the fact more business owners are giving bonuses this year says customers are coming in the door in greater numbers.
Which bodes well, of course, for the whole economy. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
With the infighting in Washington over the fiscal cliff, there is uncertainty over the future of tax deductions for gifts to nonprofit organizations. That shouldn't even be a discussion, in the opinion of author and philanthropist Kevin Salwin. If anything, he argues, we need to encourage more giving.
Let's start with what we Americans broadly agree on. We want a more opportunity-filled society. In other words, a renewed American dream where those born into tough circumstances can climb out of the hole. We want new cures for disease and new innovations. We want our education system to be better. The problem is, how do we fund it all? Conservatives hate government as an instrument of social change, and liberals don't trust private industry to handle the chore either. So how do we get more solutions without more government or profit motive? Well, I propose we make better use of one of the more trusted sectors in our society, nonprofit groups. Just think of the potential. Less HUD, more Habitat for Humanity. Less EPA, more Riverkeepers. Jobs programs would become more innovative. Medical researchers could experiment with new Alzheimer's treatments. You get the picture. As Uber philanthropist Bill Gates has noted, nonprofits are able to take risks that companies and government can't. After all, it's easier for charitable organizations to experiment with a visionary donor's money than forcing a government official or CEO to explain why a certain risk failed. But we need to pay for all that good work. That's why we need what I'm calling the Great Tithe. Currently, Americans donate about $218 billion a year to charity. And that's generous for sure, but it's still just 2% of our annual incomes. If we increase that percentage to 10%, we could raise more than $1 trillion. That's more than current federal spending on welfare, education, medical research, and transportation combined. I'm not naive. There would be plenty to work out with the Great Tithe. How big would our tax deductions be? How would we vet the nonprofits? Would the system of 10% giving be mandatory or optional? And I'm not saying nonprofits are perfect. They have their management issues too. But I can tell you this for sure. The next great program in education, medicine, or poverty relief is already percolating in the mind of some budding nonprofit entrepreneur. Why wouldn't we want to fund that?
Kevin Salwin and his daughter Hannah are co-authors of The Power of Half, One Family's Decision to Stop Taking and Start Giving Back.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
If you're thinking about making a charitable donation before the year ends, listen up, especially if you intend to enjoy the tax deductions that come with it. Reforming the tax code, including charitable donations, has been part of the ongoing debate in Congress, and what will or won't be allowed affects lots of taxpayers. Shireen Marisol Meraji is a reporter on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. She joins me now to talk about what all of this could mean for you. Hey, Shireen.
Hey.
So, first off, why do any of us get a government kickback for giving in the first place, and when did this all start?
Well, the federal government needed revenue to pay for World War I, so it started, you know, almost 100 years ago. And it was taxing the rich at incredibly high rates to do that, the highest being 77%. At that time, income taxes were paid by the top 4 or 5% of earners, and the powers that be were worried those earners would stop giving to charities. Tax historian Joe Thorndike told me that's why we have the charitable tax deduction.
The theory being that especially rich people who are paying a lot of tax on that last dollar of income will be motivated to give more if they can save money on their taxes.
Joe wrote the book Fair Share, Taxing the Rich in the Age of FDR, and he says this was a deduction designed to benefit the rich because, well, they were the ones paying income taxes 100 years ago.
All right, so 100 years ago, this is how that worked. But what about now? Who benefits from the charitable tax deduction today?
Well, let's fast forward to another war,
okay.
World War II. The government broadened the tax base. More people are paying income taxes, and more people, in theory, have access to the charitable tax deduction. But the deduction only works for people who itemize their taxes and can go over their standard deduction. Americans usually itemize because they have a mortgage. So if you meet the standard deduction and gave to your favorite nonprofit...
Bums on the street do not count as a nonprofit organization, although a lot of people think they do, as well as cousins and uncles and wayward children.
That's my tax guy, Keith Clark. He says if you can jump through the hoops, and a majority of us can't, you'll save more on your taxes. And the more you make, the more you'll save.
All right, let's talk about how that works. Break that down for us.
Well, let's say you're well off and in the 35% tax bracket and give a $1,000 donation to the Red Cross. You're going to get a $350 tax break on that donation. But if you make less and you're in the 25% tax bracket, you'll only get a $250 tax break on that $1,000 donation to the Red Cross. Now, that has some economists saying, hold up. It makes no sense for a broke federal government to subsidize donations from rich people more than from middle class people. They say everyone should get the same subsidy for giving. And if the subsidy is at a lower rate for everyone, that means more revenue for the government.
So the whole thing about charitable deductions has been on the table with the fiscal cliff conversation.
That's right.
There's no way to know for sure. Is it likely, though, to go away, do you think?
So we might not know that until January 1st, but charities are afraid they'll end up the losers if the deduction changes in any way. They think if people get less back from the government, they'll donate less. I spoke with John Ashman. He's the president of the Association of Gospel Rescue Missions.
At a time when we should be encouraging everyone to give to help the poor, we seem to be experimenting with a disincentive.
So we're experimenting here. Nothing has been done yet to change the charitable tax deduction, and Americans can still take advantage of it on their 2012 taxes. But 2013, that could be a different story, Tony.
So until things change, we should continue to do what we have been doing. And if you think that it is going to change, this would be the year to make that deduction count for you, right?
That's right. Get your donation on.
That's pretty good, Cherie. Thanks. So we're also going to be hearing from you a little later in the show.
That's right. I'm doing a piece about how you can participate in the gift-giving season when you're low income and you don't have a lot of expendable cash.
Shireen Marisol Meraji is a reporter on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Shireen, thank you.
Thank you.
Tax time may not be until April, but now is the time to start getting your tax plan in order. There are decisions to be made for sure, like charitable donations, making big purchases or not, and most of all, sorting out all the paperwork you'll need for filing your return, and of course, putting it where you can find it. It's a chore many of us put off till the last minute, and this year probably is no different. But with the fiscal cliff, you remember that, hanging over all our heads, this year, 2012, year-end tax prep takes on a special meaning. And so we've invited financial expert Louis Barajas to come be with us and give you some tax tips and take a few of your questions. Louis, I hear you've been away. Welcome back from vacation.
Tony, it's a pleasure.
Being prepared is the thing. And in fact, we are talking about preparation. And in this case, we're going to talk about tax preparation. And we have some callers who have some questions for you, Louis Barajas. So let's go to the first one.
Let's hear them out.
This is Andrew, who is calling us from the Big Apple. I think you just made a move. Is that right, Andrew?
Yes, that's right.
San Antonio, Texas to Manhattan.
That's correct. And what an adjustment this is.
That's a big change.
Yeah.
No kidding. In addition to putting up everything I own into a portable storage unit to take out here, I also had to divest myself of every asset that wouldn't fit into it. So, it's been quite the change.
So what question do you have for Lewis?
Most of it relates to this move and how it affects my taxes. I've heard that it's possible to deduct moving expenses from your income. And then I also wanted to know, since I sold my car, San Antonio being a very car-focused city, and moved up to Manhattan, where it would be more of a liability than an asset to have one of those around here. How does the move and selling my car figure into my tax burden and what I can do with my taxes this year?
You know, Andrew, you actually went from one of the lowest places you're going to be taxes because the state of Texas does not have a state tax return. And now you've moved to New York. And the surprise is going to be not that you're going to have to pay state taxes, but you're also going to have to pay city taxes, or they call them boroughs out
right.
there. So my suggestion, have you found a job yet?
I am in the process of looking for one right now. I've got a couple of leads, but nothing that I've gotten an offer on yet.
Okay. So you didn't move out there because you had another job. Most likely you moved out there because of a woman. Am I going to guess here?
You are, in fact, correct.
You sound like a young guy. I figured you would have moved out there for a woman. Okay. That's great. So technically, if you're going to find another job within the same industry that you're in, you are going to have deductions for moving your, you know, the travel expenses, the moving of your furniture, lodging expenses, except for meals. You don't get meals. But if you're going to go into a different industry, most likely you're not going to be able to take that deduction. And since you really don't have a job out there already, it's going to be difficult for you to take that deduction. But you can still actually take a different kind of deduction. You can take potential job hunting or job search expenses. Okay. And that's another thing. So when you get your taxes done, talk to your tax preparer about that. And so right now, if you're putting together your resume, you're spending money on looking for another job, you're hiring a headhunter, whatever you have to do, save those bills because you might be able to take those deductions. And the reason why I want you to get a tax projection is because once you start earning income, let's say you're making the same amount of money that you were making back in Texas, in San Antonio, you're going to owe a lot more. And so you need to do estimated taxes, or you're going to have to change your withholdings. You know, that ugly W-4 form that you have to complete when you get a new job. And so maybe in Texas you had single and two or something, or single and one. You might have to put single and zero and have them pull out more taxes from your new job. The other thing is that you said you sold a car, right?
Correct.
So what did you originally purchase that car for?
I paid, I think, about $16,500, and I sold it for exactly a third of that.
Yeah, you're not going to pay any taxes on that as well, okay? So if you're not making money on it, you're good to go.
Oh, great.
Andrea, hope that that helped you out a little bit.
I do believe it did. Thank you very much, Lewis, and thank you, Tony.
Great.
Take care, Andrew.
Thank you for calling. Let's go to another caller. This is Olivia from Cincinnati.
Hi. So excited to be on the show. I listen every week, and my husband and I pretty much plan our lives around listening to Marketplace and Marketplace Money.
Well, we are glad that you do that, and we hope that you would continue. Now, I understand that your call has some sadness to it because of the loss last year of your father-in-law.
Correct. So the question concerns the 529 that we set up for my husband's little brother, who's 8 years old. We set it up on the morning of the funeral so that people would have something to contribute to in lieu of flowers. But despite being avid listeners of the show, we didn't really have time to research and we didn't know what we were doing and didn't even realize that 529s were all about state taxes, not federal taxes. So we just went with the easiest thing and set it up through my husband's Vanguard account, which happens to be based in Nevada. So we're not really planning on taking any advantage of the 529 for our state taxes because it's really convenient for other people to contribute to it the way we have it set up. But we are thinking maybe we could claim that that $3,000 initial investment as a gift to our little brother. What do you guys think about that?
That's a great question. And by the way, for people who are listening and who don't know what a Section 529 plan is, it's a college savings account. And it's, you know, it's tax deferred, meaning you're putting money into the plan, it grows, and then you'll never have to pay taxes on the growth or the interest or the dividends if you use it for tuition, room and board, and other things that the kid will use for college. Now, here's the biggest confusion there is that whenever you gift something to someone, people think that you can take a deduction for it, but you can't actually. And the person who receives the gift doesn't have to claim it as taxable income to them. That was your concern, right? If I'm giving them that money, will I be able to deduct it, correct?
Well, yeah. Well, I kind of remember something on Shawshank Redemption, I think, about a one-time gift to someone. So that's where the question came from.
Right. And technically, you'll hear that if you give money to someone, and for 2012, it's going to be $13,000. If you give more than $13,000 to a child, let's say you did, you must file a gift tax return, and that's correct. Now, the gift tax return is just for informational purposes only, because what happens is when people pass away, they have an exclusion amount. Now, right now in 2012, we have the exclusion amount is $5,120,000. And Tony, you were talking about that fiscal cliff,
right?
That beginning January 1st, if they don't, Congress doesn't pass it, you know, extend this, it goes back down to $1 million. of assets, when you die over $1 million, then you must pay estate taxes on that. So in this situation, since you're only gifting $3,000, there's no gift tax return. You can gift $13,000. Your husband could give $13,000, and you don't have to worry about any kind of reporting.
Yeah, definitely.
Olivia, thank you very much. We're very sorry for your loss, and good luck with
thank
what
you.
You're trying to do. It's a good thing. We have another caller. This is Leslie from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Leslie, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for taking my question.
We appreciate having you call in. What can Louis Barajas help you answer?
Well, unfortunately, in December of last year, I ended up being in a car accident. And one thing that resulted from this is I ended up being a plaintiff in a lawsuit. And the question that I'm trying to figure out is that I have medical expenses that have been accrued in 2012, but the settlement's not going to happen until 2013. So I'm trying to figure out really how to handle the taxes related to expenses, you know, what I can deduct, what I should deduct, as well as also taxes on the settlement. And a major reason for me trying to figure this out is I just graduated and my student loans are going to be kicking in soon. And I don't want to do anything that might artificially inflate my income.
Leslie, first, are you okay?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
So it's a great question, and it's actually a loaded question. There's a lot of things to talk about. We'll go through them quickly. First of all individual taxpayers are cash basis taxpayers, meaning that you must take the deduction in the year that you spent the money and you must include the income in the year that you get the money. In your situation, you spent the money in medical bills in 2012, so you will take them this year, and the form that you take them in is a Schedule A and under the medical section. But remember, the first 7.5% of your adjusted gross income, which is the last number on the front page of your tax return or the very top number of the second page of the tax return, whatever that is, I'll make it real simple. Let's say you were making $100,000, 7.5% is $7,500, correct? If you had spent $7,000 in medical bills, you would not get a nickel of deduction. Now, is it deductible? Yes. But do you get to take the deduction? No. Now, let's say that you get income in 2013. Now, it depends on what the settlement was for. If it was for lost wages, the money must be declared and it's taxable.
Okay.
If it were for medical bills, anything above and beyond that you were able to deduct, let's say that you were able to deduct $2,000 and the settlement was $3,000, then you would have to report $1,000 of taxable income. But most likely it's never over the medical bill amount, and so it's never really taxable. If the money that you're receiving is for physical injuries or pain and suffering, it's tax-free. You don't have to report it.
Okay.
If it's for emotional and mental anguish, it's taxable. If it was for property damage, they're paying you because they hit your car, it's generally not taxable. And if there's punitive damages, going after the person who you think went after you maliciously, then it is taxable. So you can see how there's different ways of how you characterize what happened to you and how you're going to report that income. That's why it's important, I think, that you actually have somebody who knows what they're doing. And you always want to find an accountant who's a specialist in taxes, because not all CPAs do tax returns. So they may not increase, unless it's a huge settlement, increase your taxes. Now, you're saying, well, what about my student loans? Now I'm going to have to start paying on them, correct?
Right. And I'm looking forward to the income-based student loans, and so that's why I don't want it to go up.
Well, yeah, I understand that. And, one of the things that you also understand, that you're going to pay interest on these student loans, correct?
Correct.
So you're going to be able to take those as a deduction as well. So that's something you want to take a look at.
That's wonderful. Leslie, unfortunately, our time is up, so we have to say goodbye to you. But I hope this was helpful, and thank you for calling us.
Great. Thank you so much.
Louis, it was good talking to you. Louis Barajas, financial expert, is author of the book My Street Money, A Street-Level View of Managing Your Money from the Heart to the Bank. Louis, again, thank you very much, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays, Tony. Thank you so much.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
This time of year, the spirit of volunteerism begins its slow creep out of the deepest reaches of the cerebral cortex and sends well-meaning people in search of a deserving outlet for a helping hand. Commentator Zachary Slobig says, for the greater good, please resist that impulse.
Here's the hard truth. Soup kitchens don't need you on Thanksgiving. They don't need you on Christmas. They've got those days covered. They need you those other 363 days of the year. They need a dedicated core of volunteers to spread out that spirit of service through the entire calendar and for a true culture of volunteerism to take hold. I was 8 years old when I first stepped foot into the soup kitchen So Others Might Eat in Washington, D.C. It was a Tuesday in September. It was also the early 80s, and federal funding cuts had turned scores of homeless people into the streets. That dining room filled up with a parade of humanity, from families with kids my own age to old folks all alone. Over the next 3 hours, my parents, my three brothers, and my sister, along with a handful of other volunteers, and Smitty, some's garrulous and toothless kitchen boss, cooked a stack of French toast big enough to feed 1,000 people. We brewed huge pots of black coffee, mixed massive pitchers of powdered milk, and we set each place at the table with as much care as a server at a state dinner. We would do the same every month on a Tuesday morning until I moved away from my parents' house a decade later. Homelessness is on the rise in most U.S. cities, and in my hometown of Washington, D.C., the gap between rich and poor has never been wider and the need has never been greater. So after the holidays have passed, why not find a local soup kitchen and commit to serving just one day in the year ahead? It may become a habit.
Zachary Slobig is senior editor for the online magazine Good. You know, we Americans really are generous with our money. Not only do we contribute a big chunk of our pay to the IRS each year, we also give plenty to our employers. Don't believe it? According to a new survey of full-time workers, a majority of those polled will not use all their earned vacation and will likely lose it. Work-life consultant Joe Robinson has been studying this trend for some time. He is the author of Work to Live. Joe, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
So Americans don't take enough time off work for vacation. Why is that?
People are afraid these days. They're afraid to take their vacations for fear they might be laid off. And they're caught up in devices. Constant connectivity has really made a big impact on people, and they find a hard time to pull away, to focus long enough to set up time to take off, or, you know, just the fear, the panic of being away from their devices or missing something. And so that also intrudes into your vacation. You don't have much of a vacation as a result. Humans are no different than cell phones or iPods. We need to get recharged on a regular basis as well. In fact, taking a vacation is as important as watching your cholesterol or getting exercise.
What is the ideal amount of vacation time that an American worker should have today?
About 2 weeks off. That is the amount of time you need to recover from burnout.
When I take vacation, it takes a week to just get ready to be on vacation. And by the time I'm into it, it's time to go back to work.
Well, that's why you need a lot more than the long weekend, which is what most people are getting right now. You need the 2 weeks to get the recuperative benefits where you regather crashed emotional resources, like a sense of social support and mastery. These come back, but you need a certain amount of time. If you can have more than that, that's great. But again, all of this is only going to fly if it works within the parameters of the organization that you work for. And that means planning it and really building it into the whole organism of the organization. That's what they do in other nations where people in January, they figure out when they're going to be gone, how much time they're going to be gone. Everything is budgeted accordingly, and it becomes a planned absence. So it's not an interruption because it's all figured into the workflow and the operation.
I was under the impression, maybe falsely so, that we were entitled to vacation if we worked at a job, that they had to give it to us. But apparently that's not the case.
No, it's not the case. We are really among a handful of countries in the world where we do not have a mandated time off law. We're there with Lesotho and Chad and North Korea. I mean, it's not a great group. And what we find happens is that when something doesn't feel legitimate, because it's essentially, it's not legitimate, it's not a law, it's up to the employer to decide how much time you have off, then there is this ambiguity then, is this really okay for me to take time? And then for the employer, they kind of, we all play in this game of, well, I feel guilty if I'm going to take the time, or you're not doing your job if you take the time. And we get into this thing where it's not really acceptable to do it. And so this kind of layer, as well as the cultural layer of ambivalence about stepping back from work, because we define ourselves by our performance in this country. And if we're not performing every second, you know, we start to get a little jittery. Ah, I should be doing something. So all of this plays together to create a sense that it's kind of illicit to really take this time. That's so important for you and the company, because you're going to burn out unless you get that recovery time.
Here's my final question. I would be remiss, Joe, if I did not ask you this. How much vacation time do you take?
Well, I get about 4 weeks a year. And so I like to take one longer trip of about 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks. And then I like to break it up, you know, with 5 days here or there. In the past, I have usually gotten 3 weeks, usually by saying, okay, I'll do the extra week without pay.
That's not vacation. That's unemployment. If you're off and you're not being paid.
Well, not to somebody who really loves to travel and who needs the time to get out there and have fun. So
gotcha. It's
a trade-off.
Gotcha. Vacation advocate Joe Robinson, author of Work to Live. Joe, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Enjoy your vacation.
You too.
Tis the season for gift giving, because we want to show our love and appreciation to family and friends, or maybe we just feel like we have to. Whatever the reason, buying presents is hard for folks who are struggling, just as our economy is. So how do we give gifts without breaking the bank, a bank that may already be on life support? Marketplace's Shireen Marisol Meraji has some ideas in this report.
And what are you going to make?
A Christmas tree.
A Christmas tree?
Yeah. It's Christmas time at the winter home in Allen Park, a suburb of Detroit.
Sleigh bells ring.
My name is Heather Winter, and I have two children, Raymond, who is 7, and Elizabeth, who is 3. And then I have my husband, Seth, who is on his way home from work right now.
Walking in a winter wonderland.
How was work?
Heather and Seth Winter work for a parking company that does valet service. Combined, they make about $25,000 a year. No benefits.
I would say that we might be on the top edge of poverty.
The Winters pay out of pocket for their health insurance, and they have a mortgage and home equity loan. The kids' health care needs are covered by Medicaid, and Heather Winter feeds her family with help from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or food stamps. She says the holidays can be stressful, especially when her 7-year-old asks for something they just can't afford.
You know, he'll want like a $50 Lego thing, and that's just not in our budget right now. And so I've been trying to hint at that Santa might be on a budget this year, which he likes to come back with, but his elves can make it.
Heather and her husband, Seth, in their role as Santa's elves, have put away $200 in cash for their Christmas budget this year. They keep it cash only, no buying gifts on credit. Seth scraps cars for extra cash.
They were paying $13 a car battery, and he had like 8 of them.
And Heather fills out online surveys.
And I managed to get $56 out of that.
Heather says she's going to use some of the money to buy the kids toys, but she makes most of her gifts. Homemade jams, spice rubs, and pajamas from fabric store remnants. Personal finance expert Farnoosh Tarabi says when you're low on funds, the winter's cash-only rule is the way to go.
It's hard to part with cash. It actually hurts from a psychological standpoint, as opposed to swiping that credit card.
And says Tarabi, if you're going to a holiday party where gift giving is a must, but buying for more than one person is impossible, say these two words, Secret Santa.
So maybe be that person who is a little daring and speaks up on behalf of everybody else and makes that suggestion.
She adds that if you're buying presents, don't wait until the last minute. That's when you spend more, out of guilt. And come January, you'll be suffering from a painful holiday debt hangover. Robert Manning says going into holiday debt is still pretty standard practice. He's the CEO of the Responsible Debt Relief Institute and an economic sociologist. Manning says it makes sense that low-income families stray from strict budgets over the holidays.
If there's one time that you kind of opt out of the discipline of spending that you've adhered to through the year, this is the time that you have an opportunity to say the sacrifices were worth it, demonstrating that things aren't as bad as they've appeared over the rest of the year.
Unfortunately, he says, going off budget when you're struggling financially can mean putting gifts on plastic with out-of-control APRs or worse, taking out payday loans.
And Americans as a society are kind of at a crossroads right now. They don't know if we're going to go back to 2005 or this is the new normal.
He says, because our fiscal future is up in the air, there's a split between those who throw caution to the wind and spend like it's 2005 and those who spend within their means over the holidays.
You made an imprint of a gingerbread man.
Back at the Winters in that Detroit suburb, Mom Heather is ready for Americans to tone down all the gift buying and keep it that way.
I would hope people are looking at their budgets and not going crazy with it. You know, we need to look more at what we need versus what we want.
I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
Hi, this is Teresa Newton. I live in Portland, Oregon, and this year we're depending on homemade gifts, using our credit card points and only shopping really incredible sales or just not going out at all. No dinner, no nothing.
Hi, this is Ernie Hidalgo in North Hollywood, and my family does a Secret Santa to incorporate all family members, and then we select special gifts for immediate family members.
My name is Jessica Palumbo. I live in Tallahassee, Florida, and my family agreed we're only exchanging cookies this year instead of gifts.
Walking in a winter wonderland.
Thanks to all of you who wrote on the Marketplace and Marketplace Money Facebook walls telling us how you're going to stay on budget over the holidays. If you're cash-strapped, and who isn't, this time of year can be rough. So you say to yourself, to help make ends meet, someone or something has got to be cut. But if you're low income, it probably won't be your charitable giving. And here's why. Poorer folks tend to give more to charity than richer ones. It's true. According to a study by the Chronicle of Philanthropy, it found that those who earn $50,000 to $75,000 donate about 8% of their discretionary income. Now, that's twice as much, percentage-wise, as those making above $200,000. Paul Piff is a researcher at UC Berkeley, and he studied this phenomenon. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tony. Thanks so much for having me on. It's really a pleasure.
Glad to have you. You'd think, though, Paul, that not having as much would make a person stingy, more protective of their limited resources. But apparently that is not the case. So why are lower income people more inclined toward charitable giving?
That's right. That's really a curious pattern that we've been documenting in upwards of, at this point, 30 different studies. And what we've been finding is that people who have less give more. And that's in part because when you study the psychology of having less and the psychological features of poverty, you find that people on the lower ends of the economic ladder are a little more sensitive to the needs of other people. They're a little more empathetic and compassionate. And as a result, they know what it's like to be in need, and they know how significant and profound an impact on a person's life even small acts of charity can have. And it's really as a result of these really just basic tendencies to really be sensitive to other people, they tend to be more generous.
Does this mean that wealthy people are less compassionate?
Indeed. We've documented this across a lot of different kinds of studies. And even when in our lab, researchers have looked at what happens when I show a person images of other people suffering, and if I measure even their physiological activity, so their heart rate, on a basic physiological level, wealthier individuals show less compassion, show less responsiveness even to raw and profoundly impactful images of other individuals suffering. Wealth, we're finding, gets you to be a little more disengaged from other people, a little more sort of focused on yourself. And as a result, it creates this kind of buffer, this kind of insularity between yourself and other people.
Now, you've done some social experiments that have led you to the conclusion that the poor do, in fact, give more. Tell us about a couple of those.
One of the first experiments that we ran on this basic issue, we used this standard measure that's used by economists and by social psychologists. It's called the dictator game. Participants came into the lab and we actually gave them $10, 10 physical dollars, and said that it was up to them to decide how many of these dollars, if any, they wanted to share with an anonymous person that they'd been partnered with in the study. So it's a stranger. We tell participants that they've been partnered with the stranger, that they can keep the $10 or decide if they want to give any of these dollars away to this other person. But they'll never meet the other person. The other person will never meet them. So it's totally anonymous. There's really no reason necessarily for a person to give unless they're feeling inclined to be generous. And what we found, surprisingly at the time, was that individuals who have less, so even those individuals who, say, make under $15,000 a year, were giving on average somewhere around 7 of their $10 away to this other person, compared to people who are by all standards relatively wealthy. Individuals who made $200,000 or $250,000 a year were only giving away on average about 2 or 3 of those dollars.
How would you characterize the difference between a wealthy person making a philanthropic donation, building something really big that we read about in the news, and compare that to what someone of lesser means is able to give?
There are really notable examples of wealthy individuals and super rich individuals, people like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, who make these very philanthropic acts. And they're often public acts. Sometimes a wealthy individual will, say, donate millions of dollars to build a new gymnasium or a new kind of facility at their alma mater. And while those are notable acts of philanthropy and are importantly very, very generous, those kinds of public acts often come with all sorts of other kinds of gains for the person who does that act. So a person who gives will gain recognition in their peer groups. They'll gain esteem, they'll gain respect. And there's 20 years of research on this basic idea, but whether those acts are motivated by one's real generosity or are they in part motivated by a person's desire to gain status and recognition and prestige. But the kinds of generosity that we look at in the lab are not ones that are going to gain a person respect and recognition in their groups. They're anonymous. So we're just looking at whether or not you want to help out another person. It's not whether or not you're willing to do something to gain status in your group. It's whether you want to give up something that you might value, money, time, or something else, to help out another person, even if you don't stand to gain one bit from that act.
Fascinating information, and thank you so much for sharing it with us today. Paul Piff is a research scientist and postdoctoral scholar at UC Berkeley. Again, Paul, thank you.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Tony. Thanks so much.
You can see people carrying Christmas trees home every day now as the big holiday draws nearer. But if you haven't bought your tree yet, you still have the job of finding the right lot, the right tree, the right price, and, well, that is a job. The National Christmas Tree Association says more than 30 million trees are sold nationwide. Prices and tree variations cover a pretty wide range from a few bucks to well over hundreds of dollars, depending on the size and type of tree. Did you know there are 11 types of Christmas trees? Bet you didn't. So I'm here to help. I went to Tina's Tree Lot in Sherman Oaks, California, where she and husband Steve have been in business for more than 30 years. So get ready for a lesson in buying a Christmas tree. Hi, Tina.
Hi, how
are
you?
I'm Tony, Tony Cox.
Hi, Tony.
Marketplace Money, nice to see
nice
you.
Nice to see you.
Thank you for letting us come out to,
my
your,
pleasure.
To your lot. How's business?
Business is great. We've had a very busy year.
Really? More so than in, like, last year or the year before?
Yes. Actually, we've been very busy. We had an early Thanksgiving, so it started right away. And usually we thought it'd be slow the first week, but it hit right away. People are buying earlier and earlier.
What are they buying?
They're buying all different sizes. We noticed a few years ago that people during the recession were buying a little bit smaller tree. But
like how small?
Well, I mean, maybe if they bought a 9-footer, they'd be buying now a 7-8.
Can you show us some of the stuff you've got?
Sure.
All right. Now, I did not know that there are like 11 different types of Christmas trees. So which one is the most
popular?
Well, the most popular is the noble fir, which is right here.
The one in front of us?
Yes.
This is the noble fir?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
They have a good look. Actually, people like all different looks. And this year, we actually started carrying the silver tip again, which I have one left out of my order, only one.
A silver tip.
And let me show you what that looks
like. Okay, I'm right
behind
you.
Because that is a very spacey, open tree.
Oh, that tall, that really tall one over there?
Yes, yes. The silver tip is a much more expensive tree because it's a very high elevation tree, and it takes a really long time to grow.
So a tree like that would cost what?
This silver tip is $220.
Oh, my.
These are the Doug firs, Douglas fir tree.
Douglas firs.
And a Douglas fir tree is a less expensive tree.
So this is a six-foot Douglas fir, and this one is $42. Now, this is the kind of tree that most people have, isn't it?
Well, we sell more nobles, really, but that's a very common tree.
Very common. Okay,
yes,
there you
very
go.
Very common.
What do people want when they come in? What do they say generally when they walk in?
First thing the person maybe would say is the height they want and the type of tree. Some people do ask which is your least expensive tree, but generally speaking, people know what they want.
Really? Now, the prices on Christmas trees can range from what to what?
There is a huge variety in price, depending on the size, of course. A six-foot sign of an average-sized tree.
Right.
You know, of course, we have tabletops that are $24, $28, but...
Now, explain this to me, because I'm looking at art. This is a
Douglas fir,
six-foot, $42.
Mm-hmm.
Right here
mm-hmm.
is a, looks like a four-foot for $50, but it's a noble fir.
Okay, so here's the deal.
Okay.
A Douglas fir is a faster-growing and easier, takes less maintenance in the farm and is less expensive to buy. A noble fir, the trimming and shearing of a noble fir is more like a hand process. They cut each branch as they style it.
All right, so tell me a little bit about the tree selling business. How many trees do you buy every year? Or is that a trade secret?
No, it's not a trade secret. Just say it's... A few thousand.
All right. Now, the goal is to sell what percentage of the, obviously you want to sell them all, but what realistic percentage do you get in terms of the numbers of trees in your inventory that you sell? Do you get rid of half of them, 75% of them? You sell them all out or what?
Well, the goal, of course, is to sell them out.
Obviously.
Now, actually, I just ordered additional trees because we are having a very good year.
And what happens to the trees that are not sold? This is the 26th of December
yes.
now.
Yes, chances are we'll have some not sold. Okay. There have been years where we haven't had any, but in that case, we take them to the recycling center and they become mulch. Although many times I've had people say, can we plant them? But no, that doesn't work.
All right, Tina, thank you. We're going to go talk to a couple of your customers,
you can
I
talk
think.
To Michael.
I'm Michael.
And I'm Tony.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
How you doing?
I really look like I'm buying a tree, don't I?
You are dressed in a shirt and tie. Michael and what's your wife's name?
Colleen.
Colleen. Reagan.
Reagan.
Yes.
Reagan.
You come here every year to buy trees, do you?
We've been coming to Tina's for, 15 years.
So why do you come here?
Well, you know, it's almost like family.
A family affair.
Yeah.
So you bought your tree today?
We're buying one at a time.
Okay, so which one? Did you pick it out already?
Yes, we just got a small one because we put up three, so we got our small one for our living room.
Okay.
And what people should do when they come here, understand these guys are working their tails off, so it's always nice to give them a little something. You're buying the tree, you know, trickle down, actually give them something when you leave the room.
So now, the cost isn't really an issue for you.
Yeah, the cost is to an extent. I mean, the size tree you're going to buy... But the cost with Tina, it's reasonable.
She has a silver tip over there that's $220.
Yeah, well, that's nice. There's somebody who'll buy that.
Thank you.
And no, you're not hearing things. We really did run into conservative commentator Michael Reagan, President Ronald Reagan's son, and his wife, Colleen, at Tina's Trees in Sherman Oaks, California. Really? That's Marketplace Money for this week. Let us know what you think at marketplace.org or on our Facebook page.
and keep up with the show on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, Gene Chotsky on money rules you need to adopt in the new year.
You've got to track your dollars like calories, which means know where your money is. Know what's coming in, know what's going out, and where it's going.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Tony Cox. We'll see you next week. This is APM.